Hello, and welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge onto you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, a professional mountain guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains, and I chipped my tooth, and it made a loud noise, giving an ice axe arrest demonstration to clients in front of the owner of the guiding service on my very first day working on Mount Rainier in Washington. The Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Alta Ski Area. Come for the skiing, stay for the skiing. My guest today is Mark Staples, the director of the Utah Avalanche Center. He was a professional ski patroller at Big Sky Ski Area in Montana before earning a master's degree in engineering at Montana State University as part of their snow science program. Mark wrote his thesis on energy balance at the snow surface and weak layer formation. After grad school, Mark worked as a backcountry avalanche forecaster for the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center in Bozeman, Montana. Mark has an undergraduate degree in engineering from the University of Virginia. Mark is also a passionate skier, snowboarder, and ice climber, as well as a father of three. Good morning, Mark. How are you? Thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Thank you, Miles. I'm excited. Excited to be part of the show as you're, it seems like you're just getting it off the ground.
Just getting it off the ground. And I'm honored to be able to talk to, you know, high up, intelligent people like yourself. So I really appreciate you being here. Let's just jump into a couple things to kind of warm up here. How many square miles does the Utah Avalanche Center create avalanche forecasts for each day?
We've got about 5,000 square miles across the state where we do forecasting. But obviously, there are certain areas that have pretty high concentrations of use. Anyone familiar with the Wasatch knows the Cottonwood Canyons are, they have all the ski areas and tons of great backcountry riding to do.
How many people work at the Utah Avalanche Center? Like, how many people would you have in the field each day?
We really only have a few people out, yet we're doing forecasts across the state. So that's where we really, really rely on all of our partners, like at the ski areas, different guides, anybody who sends in observations so that we can take all that data and combine it with just the few targeted observations we get to do our forecast and get information to the public.
According to the Utah Avalanche Center, during the 2019-2020 winter season, Utah's backcountry experienced 314 human-triggered avalanches. 28 people were caught in those avalanches, including myself. 15 people were buried, and sadly, two were killed. How do you think the coronavirus shutdown affected the triggering of avalanches in the Utah backcountry last season?
The shorter answer is we don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
But in simple terms, if you put more people into the mountains, that means more triggers, and there's probably a higher likelihood of finding those spots where people can trigger avalanches. So more people tends to equal more avalanches.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that goes along with the question I was going to ask next, which is after the ski resorts closed due to coronavirus concerns, what happened in the Utah backcountry?
All sorts of users were out. We saw tons of snowmobilers, tons of people snowshoeing, and whatever the reasons why, I just think it's awesome that people chose to go out. It's obviously probably safer to be outside in the mountains in the fresh air. So I thought that was just really cool. And it's gone on all summer long. Folks have chosen to go out and recreate in the mountains, which is really cool.
I think that is cool. And I agree. I think there was some backlash for a little bit with, you know, people being upset with other people going skiing. And then I think the tide turned and people understood, well, actually, this is a healthy, safe, well, socially distanced activity. So I'm glad to hear, you know, that's being echoed in other places. With COVID restrictions at ski resorts this upcoming season, more people will be in the backcountry skiing and riding than ever. How do you think that will affect Utah's backcountry?
It means we have a lot of people going into some pretty tight spaces. It's been something I think all of us, whether you're a skier or a snowboarder, snowshoer, ice climber, snowmobiler, we've all seen is there are more people out there. Even something as simple as parking at different trailheads is an issue. Probably this year more than others, we're going to have to work together and try and be tolerant and help each other out so that we can all share this great resources that we have, the mountains and the snow that we get here in Utah.
That's one of the best things I've heard said about that yet. And so some other people in the industry are going to be pushing a message saying, this season, the backcountry is going to be more busy than ever. Let's all be cool, basically. Let's be tolerant. Yeah, let's be understanding. Let's be empathetic. Let's be, God forbid, let's be helpful instead of giving this, hey, you know, vibe of, hey, this is my territory. Because we know it's going to be busier in the backcountry, have some flexibility, go early, have a backup plan or two. And again, I think let's just be tolerant. Let's be helpful. Let's be friendly. I think those are pivotal. So thank you so much for bringing that up. So you have over 1 million people who live within a 45-minute drive of the Wasatch Mountains, which holds some of the best and most avalanche-prone backcountry skiing and riding on Earth. How does having over 1 million people so close to great backcountry skiing and riding in such consequential avalanche terrain affect the Wasatch backcountry?
Well, what it means is you can go from your living room to avalanche terrain really quickly. Because you can access this terrain so quickly, you can oftentimes squeeze in a few hours of getting out and riding in between all the other things we have going on in life. We've got a great talk coming up at USAW. A guy was caught in an avalanche a couple years ago out of Park City. He's got a great story of how he was trying to coordinate things with his wife, take one kid, drop them off at school here, do this one thing for work. And then he was like, oh, now I'm going to quick run up. I was like, he was going to go skiing, I think, at a Park City mountain resort and then go into the backcountry from there. But he had all this other stuff on his mind and he was totally distracted. And even when he got out, he was then distracted by all the other things he had to do, you know, when he was done and he got back to his car. He had already been taxed mentally with everything he had to do that morning. Got out, going skiing for him was his escape. But he couldn't fully escape because he knew he had to be back by a certain time. And then he had to pick up another one of his kids somewhere else. He had to drop something else off for his wife and then do this and that and that. And the last thing he was thinking about were avalanches. And that really made it hard to just totally focus on the real life and death issue at hand. And those distractions really piled up. And that was a function of this amazing access we have.
I agree. And what would be your advice? Because that's something we all are carrying around with us as a mental burden when we go into the backcountry, almost all of us in Utah. So what is your advice to people to try to avoid that scenario where you're not thinking about what you're doing right now in avalanche terrain?
Well, it's a tough one. I think it's something we all struggle with, right?
Like I do.
How do you disconnect from this stuff? I think so many other sports we do, I think of like whitewater or mountain biking or climbing or so many other things, dirt biking, all these things, the danger and the hazard is obvious. You can see it. If I'm on my bike and I slam into that rock, I'm going to go over the handlebars and hit that tree. When it comes to avalanches, the snow is soft. It's fluffy. It's white. A lot of times what creates the danger lies hidden beneath in these layers. And I just don't think it's as apparent, and it makes it harder to maybe strip away some of those stresses and distractions because that danger isn't just jumping out in your face.
I agree. And one story that really impacted me is the guys that ran Teton AT, that great website from Jackson Hole. They went backcountry skiing in the Teton National Park. And one of the guys had to pick up his dad at the airport. And they were in a hurry and they ended up in an avalanche. And his dad, it actually brings tears to my eyes right now, just thinking, it gives me pinpricks all over. His dad is who he had to pick up at the airport, and his dad would have loved to have been picked up late. Loved it. But that's not how you feel. You feel, I got to get there. I got to do this. You lose focus, and really bad things can happen. So thank you for covering that. That is absolutely pivotal, and I hope that is driven home to our users, especially in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. You know, one thing I can add, it's critical to know what's under our feet. And when I talked about that danger being obvious, like that compared to other sports where it's right in front of you, you can see in whitewater, you can see that hole that you want to avoid. And in snow, you don't, because a lot of times the problems are hidden, they're lurking beneath our feet. So first of all, it just helps to like stop, dig in the snow and see what's under your feet. It's really important. Even if you don't know, if you're new to it, the only way you're going to learn is by digging in the snow, seeing and feeling those layers. But more importantly, I think when I dig into the snow and I get down in there, now I'm eye level with the snow surface. it changes the way I think about things. When I see that gnarly weak layer down at the ground and I realize if an avalanche is going to break, it's going to break 3 or 4 feet deep. When I'm down in the snow, I feel more vulnerable. It shifts my thinking a little bit. When I'm on top of the snow, I'm thinking about how awesome this powder is going to be and how great the riding is going to be. And so stopping and digging, it's almost a decision-making tool because it engages different emotions for me. Maybe you don't see anything that's relevant in that snow pit, but it brings the group together and you can talk about it and then extrapolate out to where you are going to be riding, the slope in question, the slopes in question, and have a conversation about that specifically, a real focused conversation. Whenever you can provide a sort of stop and think moment or a pause, and when you're dealing with a group, that is critical. And personally, sometimes I'm out with people who are like 10 times more fit than I am.
That's so, every day for me.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll just be like, oh, I got to dig a snow pit. And they're like, oh, okay. All right. I use it as like a chance to like take a break and catch a breath.
I'm going to remember this.
But what it does is it can bring the group together. And I don't know if you've ever seen groups that get strung out, whether it's two or three people or four or five people that get strung out. And I think of it as an opportunity to bring the group together, create that pause, create that moment to talk about avalanches and the snowpack, and maybe pull us away from talking about how amazing the snow is going to be and really fine-tuning the focus on the snow.
That is extremely insightful, and I hugely appreciate you seemingly almost creating that, you know, for us right now. So I agree, the benefits of digging in snow, it gives us time to reflect on the reality of the situation and the consequences, brings the group together. And I think you're right. It would help solidify, make a plan. So it's like, because once somebody digs, now you're asking questions. Hey, what should we do? You know, what's going on here? And then I really, really like the idea of it giving you a rest, because my buddy Ben just smokes me. I don't need that. I need to take a break and dig a hole in the snow. So great, great advice. Great insight. Thank you for that, Mark.
Yeah, yeah. Can I mention one more thing about it?
I want you to.
I view it as my rescue practice, because what I'm doing is I'm whipping my pack off, pulling out my shovel, putting it together, and digging. And digging someone out of an avalanche is by far the hardest thing you're going to do. Physically digging someone out. That snow is heavy. It's exhausting. That's the hard part. So digging snow pits for me, it sounds so simple, but I get used to in cold weather, hot weather, with my gloves on, I get used to putting my shovel together. And I've learned, at least for me, for my body, which techniques work really well to dig. So I would also, you know, it's hard maybe sometimes at the parking lot to be that person who's like, hey, no, let's do some rescue practice. You just kind of want to get going. So view that snow pit, dig down to the ground. That is a great chance to just get super efficient and quick with your gear. And you'll be more ready for rescue if you've done that a few times.
I love it. This list is fantastic. So stopping digging in the snow gives us a chance to reflect on the reality of the situation and the consequences, helps get the group together, helps you make a plan, helps you take a break from your buddies who are racers, basically. Mm-hmm. And then it also gives you some rescue practice, because you have to physically get your shovel out, put it together and use it, and then put it all back mm-hmm. again. So mm-hmm. amazing. Thank you very much for that. All right. Yeah. So we'll jump into the next one here. That was phenomenal. Thank you very much, Mark. During the 12-month period from January 2019 to January 2020, six people died in avalanches in Utah. And in all six of these tragic events, mm-hmm. the people involved were missing critical pieces of avalanche gear. There were also two avalanche deaths in the nearby Teton Mountains last winter, mm-hmm. where both victims were wearing avalanche transceivers and both of their transceivers were turned off. It's devastating. Yeah. What's your gut reaction to hearing these statistics?
What I think of is an accident in 2009 when a good friend of mine died. What had happened was he was actually snowmobiling. He was riding with his best friends and his wife, the mother of their newborn child. And during the middle of the day, they had gone back into town for lunch and he had turned his transceiver off, maybe to save the batteries, not sure what. And when they went back out, he forgot to turn it on again. At the end of the day, he was caught in a massive avalanche that broke at the ground, made this enormous pile of debris. They were doing a lot of stuff right. His friends and his wife were all parked off to the side. They knew how to use their gear. They were ready. And as soon as the debris came to rest, they immediately sprang into action, turned their transceivers to receive, and then pretty quickly realized there was no signal. And I'll never forget, because we went down the next morning super early to help with the rescue, because they never found him that day. And the next day we had probe teams and dogs organized to go in. And the first thing we did early that morning when we rolled into town was we went and we stopped at the hotel and checked in with Kelly, his wife. And you can just imagine spending the night in a hotel in a small town in rural Montana, knowing your husband and your best friend is still out there, buried in the snow, cold, probably dead. And it was the absolute worst night of her life. And that's what I think about. And I think about when we saw Kelly, and then we went out to find Travis. We did a dog, found him later that day. This is, in some respects, sadly, this is nothing new. And I've seen it time and time again at trailheads. I've walked around with my transceiver, and whether it's at a trailhead for snowmobilers, whether it's a gate at a ski area for the side country, we see people going time and time again into the backcountry without this gear. I don't know why it just sort of all of a sudden caught up with us. And maybe it was just a coincidence that we had this string of fatalities with people not having the gear. What it really comes down to me, whether it's rescue gear or not, is that we can never let up on the basics. It's really fun to go into some of the nuances and the more advanced topics. But the basics, it's kind of like, have you ever taken a first aid class?
Yes.
What's the main thing they always stress? And this goes all the way up to like MDs and paramedics.
ABCs.
Like, the ABCs, right. And when you get confused, what do you come back to?
Go right back to them.
The ABCs, because mm-hmm. that's what's going to kill a person. And for, I don't know if anyone listening is not familiar, the ABCs is airway, breathing, circulation. And so it doesn't matter what's going on with someone. If you cut off their airway and they can't breathe, they're going to die. So you always come back to the basics. And the same thing applies with avalanches. We always have to come back to the basics. The basics will save our life, and the beauty is they never change. The basics that apply now to 2020 were the same thing that applied in 1920, 1950. And when you read some of the old literature and the old books, they talk about the same stuff. And unfortunately, sometimes these are the things that are getting people killed.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for sharing that. And secondly, I'm so sorry that happened. I think a lot of us humans that have spent a lot of time in the mountains and avalanche terrain, we've lost close people. You know, I've lost a close friend in an avalanche in Jackson Hole. I lost my brother skiing when I was a kid, and it wasn't avalanche related, but it was in the snow and in these things. I am different from how I was before you started telling that story. It really affects me, I think, probably in the same way it does to you or anybody who's lost someone in the mountains. It's so devastating. It's so life-changing. It's so altering. So it is so important for us to really remember the basics of avalanche safety. And can't stress enough, you know, you nor I nor many people, just make sure you do that beacon check in the morning. Make sure you have all the gear. Mm-hmm. Make sure everybody in your party has all the gear. It only takes a minute or two, and it's a great practice to have. And nobody will ever fault you for wanting to do that, because I know I have personally been asked by friends after skiing in avalanche terrain, hey, let's do a quick beacon check. And my personal beacon was not on. So it happens to everybody. I've done it more than once. And I'm really, really good about it now, especially after the Hayden Kennedy story, if you know that story.
Yes.
Where a very amazing young man, an athlete, and his fiance had gone into, and her name was Inka or Ingrid, I believe. They had gone into the mountains early season, because you're a Montanan. Early season in the mountains, and they triggered an avalanche. She was buried. They were both buried, but she was fully buried. He was able to get himself out, and he couldn't find her because her beacon ended up not on and in her backpack. So they just, because they had had to walk 6 miles on dirt because it was early season, October, to get to snow, they had skipped that step by accident or meant to do it later. Just do it at the trailhead, do it at the car, get it done.
Yeah. And you know, like you, Miles, I've done the same thing. I've been in the same situation as Hayden and Inga. More often than not, it's been in the spring when I've had to hike in on some trail where I'm wearing running shoes. And I've put my transceiver in my pack, and because it's hot, it feels like summer. And for whatever reason, I mean, luckily, I've put it on before I got on the snow. But I, like you, I've also, I can remember a time teaching an avalanche class where we were doing some rescue training and practice and some beacon skills, and I turned mine off so as not to interfere with the drill that they were doing. And then we went out and we did some other things, and we went into avalanche train. And when I got back to the car, I looked down and I had never turned my beacon back on. And it just, oh, it was like a gut punch. I just felt horrible. But yeah, we all do it. And that's the thing, is that's where we have to help each other out.
I agreed. And I've experienced it. It's a gut punch, and you don't want to tell anybody, but I have always just said, all right, I'm going to tell them my beacon was not on, actually. So that's a big mistake. Let's all make a note of this and do better.
That's why we go with partners. It's not just so that we have someone to do a rescue. Our partners are there to, like, some of my best partners are the ones that'll say, Mark, what the heck are you doing, you idiot? And I really, really, really appreciate that. And so it's not just like a check on my decision making. It's they're the ones that are going to check to make sure my transceiver is on. They're the ones that I can talk to and have an honest conversation. And I just love that part about the backcountry. It's just, it's a moment too. We just have these real conversations. You know, we're talking about life or death, and with all the other junk that goes on in life, you know, back home, it's refreshing to go out and have these real consequential decisions and conversations with some of our best friends.
Agreed. And more pure, more dynamic at times, and more real, you know, human interaction. I'd really like to reiterate what you said there, because that really changed my brain. I've not thought of that ever. That the spring backcountry mentality, the approach that you take to the backcountry in the spring, where, you know, there almost isn't much back, you know, avalanche danger at all. We may take that mentality from the spring and transfer it a bit more than we'd like to the next fall. So when we get back out in the backcountry in December, for example, I think that is genius. You should write a paper on that. That is so good. I've never heard that before. So I really want to push that home, to drive that home to our audience, because this podcast is going to publish in the fall, and we're all just about to get out there, and we're all very hungry. Ski resorts have been closed. A lot of us haven't skied in at least 6 months, so we're ready to go. So that is great. How common is it to see large amounts of human-triggered avalanches in short periods of time in the Utah backcountry?
Well, it's not unheard of. And like we were talking about earlier, we have tons of people, millions of people living within 45 minutes of amazing terrain that's also avalanche terrain. I don't know what people do for a living, but it sure seems like people get powder flu and are able to take time off from work when there's good snow.
I see that too. Man, is anybody working today?
Nope. So yeah, I mean, when all those things converge, maybe some instability in the snowpack, fresh snow, lots of people, we get avalanches. So it's not uncommon.
It does seem that in Salt Lake City, you kind of have a mathematical equation for that to happen, right? You get a bunch of snow, it's sunny, lots of people live nearby, boom, they're in the mountains. Okay, yeah, we'll move on. Why is it important to report avalanche accidents and observations to your local avalanche center as soon as possible?
Well, the first and foremost is we use that information and that data to make better forecasts. And we often take the data that we have to where we think the avalanches are going to happen. And then we overlay that with where avalanches actually have been happening. So the more info we have on that, the better we can sort of really fine tune what we're giving to the public to let them know where avalanches are going to happen. Because that's a big part of our avalanche forecast. It's not just, I don't know, most people are probably familiar with the avalanche danger rating, which goes from low, moderate, considerable, high. It's green and yellow, orange, red. But an even more helpful piece of information that you get when you take an avalanche class or you learn more about avalanches is learning the types of avalanches. And then what we try and convey then is where they're going to happen. So they don't always just happen on every single slope. It's just like a lot of things in Mother Nature, they do follow some sort of pattern. And if we can identify that better, if we know where they're going to happen, it also can tell us where they're not going to happen. And we can adjust as skiers and riders, we can adjust where we go to go to the slopes that are going to hopefully be less prone to sliding. That's first and foremost. Second is kind of like you did, if we can share our stories, and I think we've come a long way as a community. It used to definitely be like a black eye or, you know, something we were embarrassed about. We've come a long way where it feels like most folks are willing to share. Obviously, social media and smartphones and everyone having a camera in their pocket has made that easier in terms of technology. And then I feel like there's less shaming that's going on. And it takes a lot of work to keep that at bay. But I think as the more that we share, it just sort of grows. I think it's ingrained us as humans. You know, we kind of humans go back hundreds of years ago. We grew up hanging around the campfire, hearing stories being passed down through the generations. And that hasn't gone away. So the power of storytelling, I think, is really how we can learn by looking at the data, but when we wrap that into a story, we really learn. So sharing these avalanches is part of that storytelling and sharing the story of what happened. And for me, at least, that's where I've learned some of my greatest lessons have been through these stories.
I think you just covered it, but I'd like to hammer it home for our audience. So I'll ask these two questions together. Why do people avoid reporting their avalanche accidents? And what does our community need to do or not do to encourage the reporting of avalanche accidents?
Look at these accidents through a lens of that could be me. And I feel like as a community, we're going to be less critical of these people and more open to hearing what they have to say so they don't feel embarrassed or shamed about sharing their story.
It appears clear that there will be many new backcountry users this winter due to coronavirus restrictions at ski resorts. If you met someone who was planning on backcountry skiing or riding for the first time this season, what advice would you give that person?
It probably doesn't really matter if they're skiing or snowboarding or snowmobiling. And I don't know how I would convey this, but I think the hardest thing to understand is how dangerous avalanches are. Snow is soft and fluffy. When the mountains get a fresh coat of snow, they just look so clean and pure and pristine. It doesn't seem dangerous. And so I fall prey to this. Luckily, I go look at a lot of avalanches, so I get constantly reminded of their power and their destruction. But it's just so easy to not feel as worried about it. Maybe what I would say, I'm just thinking about this now. So an avalanche can get going 60 miles an hour in seconds. Even a small avalanche can go that fast. But imagine just as you're driving home through the neighborhood and you're going just 25 miles an hour, which seems kind of slow, right? Stick your head out the window of the car and nail a mailbox with your head and your neck. Like, you can imagine how that would feel. And that's what's going to happen in an avalanche. 25 miles an hour is nothing. They'll be going 60 miles an hour. And now you've got trees and rocks. Hit one of those with your neck and see what happens. And so I find think about that. Driving through the neighborhood, stick your head out the window when you're going 25 miles an hour and hit something, and that's what an avalanche is going to do to you. So they're incredibly destructive, dangerous, and if you can just visualize that to appreciate the power, that's a good starting point to have a respect for this thing.
Absolutely. And to continue one of your points there, the data I've seen is that about 25% of the people who die in avalanches die from trauma from hitting objects. Mm-hmm.
2 days ago, on October 19th, a skier in Canada just died.
Yes. Oh, so sad.
And it wasn't avalanche related. It was just a thin snowpack. And it's not really clear what happened, but it sounds like they died of trauma from a fall. And that's what's especially scary about early season riding. It's dangerous to begin with because the snow is thin. And now add an avalanche into that. And you're getting tossed down a slope going 60 miles an hour, but the rocks and the stumps and the trees aren't fully covered yet. Even if there's not enough snow to necessarily bury you, the trauma of early season avalanches is particularly dangerous.
That's really strong insight. I actually had not truly thought about that before, but if there's objects to hit when you're tumbling in an avalanche, that's multiplied exponentially early season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Which is a good segue to my next question. When is the most dangerous time to backcountry ski and snowboard in Utah?
Well, in broad terms, I'd say earlier in the season typically is a little more dangerous. The most dangerous time can be any time. And that's the thing about snow, is that the snowflakes and the snow crystals are changing constantly. And that's why we put out avalanche forecasts every morning, because you can go from low danger one day to high danger the next for a variety of reasons. And avalanche forecasts can help you know that. There are a bunch of obvious clues Mother Nature can give you. You can learn those in a class or through a lot of the great online resources we have now. Things can turn on a dime and go from incredibly safe to incredibly dangerous. So I think that's my main point, is that the most dangerous time can be any time of the year. It just depends on how the weather and the snowpack unfold. And then either is multiplied or lessened by where then you put yourself and the terrain you choose.
I think that flows well into the Facebook question we got from Eric, who asks, what is the best weather to solidify faceted layers in the snowpack? And for our users, faceted layers are the dangerous layers that avalanches can happen upon.
The tough part about these faceted layers, which if you've ever looked at them, for folks who aren't familiar, it's the layers of snow and the snow crystals that when you reach into it, it feels like sugar. It's very loose. And that oftentimes is what causes a lot of avalanches that are particularly deadly. These types of snow crystals that form these weak layers can form really quickly, but they take a long time to heal. And what we call these weak layers, we call them persistent weak layers for a reason, because they're persistent and they last a long time. So there are two ways that they can heal and get stronger, and that's time and temperature. And so it takes time, and the temperature part of it is that they need to be buried under a nice thick blanket of snow, a nice deep snowpack. That will help them heal slowly over time. The catch 22, though, is as we bury them deeper, we start building up layers of snow on top of these weak layers. That also means while it's still a dangerous weak layer, we're making the avalanches get bigger and bigger and bigger. A way to think of this is sometimes these weak layers, you can think of them as the foundation for your house. And they're very weak, and we're building this house on top of them. That foundation will determine whether or not your house falls down. So we want these layers to strengthen. But obviously, if you put a one-story house on top of a poor foundation and that collapses, that's bad. But if you put a giant skyscraper on top of a poor foundation, that's going to be really, really bad. And that's kind of what happens. And that's what needs to happen in order to heal them. But eventually, they can heal. And I guess the main thing is that is where tuning into your local avalanche forecast will help. Because we will be tracking these layers. We'll be talking with maybe sometimes the ski areas are dealing with them. And we can start to let you know when they have essentially gone dormant or they have healed.
What's the best way to stay out of avalanches? And what's the number one tool available to backcountry skiers and riders in avalanche terrain?
Well, the number one tool, believe it or not, is not going into avalanche terrain.
I like that. Stay home.
Well, you know, and it's not stay at home.
Go to the ski resort, yeah.
It also means pick lower angle slopes. Mm. And it sounds really simple, but that is a tool I use, our entire staff at the Utah Avalanche Center uses, avalanche professionals around the country. This is the number one thing we do. And in general, there are obvious outliers and extreme events, but in general, avalanches won't happen on slopes that are less than 30 degrees in steepness. And so the best thing you can do is learn how to measure slope angles. You can get that in a class. There are a lot of tools. There are apps on your phone. There's a great little digital device you can buy that clicks onto a ski pole that can help you measure slope angles. And it's really eye-opening, but it takes a lot of time to learn how to measure those slope angles. The more you do it, you actually get really good at estimating that without even measuring it. So you can ride a 28-degree slope all winter long and pretty much not ever worry about avalanches. And you, most of the time when I'm doing classes, people are amazed. Like, this is actually pretty steep and pretty fun. So that, believe it or not, that is the number one tool we use to mitigate our avalanche risk, is by going to slopes that are just a few degrees less steep, and then it's not enough for an avalanche to happen.
The legendary Utah Avalanche Center director before you, Bruce Tremper, once said this about avalanche airbag backpacks: a deployed airbag saved about half of those who would have otherwise died. What's your opinion on the effectiveness of avalanche airbag backpacks? Should we all be wearing one?
Well, I think where he got that from was a study done in Canada, where they actually, it was the first time anyone had really rigorously examined some of the data. Basically, it's more complicated than some of the things that were being presented when airbags first came out, because a certain number of people who get caught in avalanches, whether they have an avalanche airbag pack or not, are going to end up on top. A certain number are going to live or die regardless of what gear we have. And so they had to filter out a lot of that stuff to really determine the effectiveness of avalanche airbags. Another big issue was that a lot of people aren't able to deploy their airbag in time. And I know for a fact, I mean, I have gone and retrieved someone who died in an avalanche. I've flown in on a helicopter to go retrieve his body and bring it home to his family. And he was wearing an avalanche airbag backpack and never had time to deploy it. It has happened time and time again. When you filter through all that data, what they found was that what Bruce said, big picture, of all the people that would die in avalanches, for whatever reason, about half of them will still die, but the other half will survive because of the airbag backpack. So that's huge, though. That is massive. That means we can cut, if everyone wore an airbag backpack, we'd cut the number of avalanche fatalities in half.
That's enormously impactful. So I hope that is something people remember. So this tool is valuable and potentially enormously valuable, your life valuable. So let's all take that to heart. Thank you for that.
Yeah. It's just like having an airbag in your car. You might be going 80 miles an hour down the interstate and be in a bad accident, and that airbag could save your life. But at the same time, when your car spins out of control going 80 miles an hour, you don't know what's going to happen. So we want to like stack the odds in our favor, and wearing an airbag certainly is one of those things, but it's by no means something that's going to guarantee survival.
Does early season snow cause dangerous weak layers in the Utah snowpack that can last all season long the way that it does in Colorado?
Absolutely. We see a lot of the same things. I think one of the things that makes Utah so amazing is we often, not always, but we often have these beautiful, warm, dry falls where we're out biking and climbing and hiking and doing all these fun sports in the fall, because the mountains, we're not getting snow. Or if we do get a little snow, it melts off. And the importance of that is, but when you do get that early season snow and it sits around, that can form dangerous weak layers. The way we can avoid that is when we have a beautiful, warm, dry fall where we don't get that early season snow. And that makes a big, big difference in stability and avalanche conditions for the entire season. It often does come at some point in Utah. That snow will fall, but it'll melt out on a lot of south-facing slopes and west-facing slopes. It'll remain on high elevation north-facing slopes. And so then a lot of times what we see as the season unfolds, at least here in Utah, is things can be incredibly dangerous and unstable, and there can be avalanches breaking out left and right on certain aspects and elevations, typically high elevation north-facing ones that retained that snow. And then things can be totally different and much more stable on other aspects and elevations. So that really comes down then to the importance of paying attention to the avalanche forecast. We're going to be tracking where that stuff exists. And ultimately what that means is, ideally, if things play out like they do historically, we will have options. There might be some slopes that are off limits, and there are other slopes where you can go ski and ride and have a great time and not worry too much about avalanches.
How many backcountry skiers and riders does the Wasatch Mountain Range typically see each winter? And has that number been going up or down? Do you guys have data on that stuff?
Well, the shorter answer is we don't. No one really does. And what we can use as proxies to estimate that are gear sales. We can look at the number of times people access our avalanche forecast, sort of the web hits. And what we do is we see, at least on our website, those numbers do go up and down with snowfall. So they don't tell us how many people are out there, but we can use those numbers to see if the number of people out in the mountains is going up or down. And obviously this year, I don't know, I think you've heard gear sales, backcountry gear, are way up. So we're suspecting that we're going to see a lot of people. Anecdotally, if you talk to anyone who's been around 10, 20 years ago, they'll all say there are more people around now than there were then. So whatever those numbers are, they're going up, which is great. And I think that's why a lot of people either elect to if they're born here, they stay here. If they're born somewhere else, they move here, because we've got some amazing places to go in the Wasatch Range. But that does mean we're seeing more and more people every year.
Absolutely. I mean, in my short experience in Utah as well, it seems that it's gotten quite a lot busier, and especially last year with the coronavirus shutdown, with, as I understand, and I think you agree, with the highest use areas being the Cottonwood Canyons, the Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. How many avalanche deaths in the U.S. do you think are avoidable?
Well, I suppose they're all avoidable. Almost every accident is avoidable, right? Very few accidents are like a bolt of lightning that comes out of nowhere. That doesn't mean they're easily avoidable.
Right.
We're human, and I know I'm human, and I'm susceptible to all the things that can lead to an accident. So perhaps going back to what we talked about at the beginning, that's where I think your partners and your friends are really key. If you're gonna go into avalanche terrain, you can do everything possible, but there's a certain amount of residual risk. So you can bring through picking your days, your terrain, having the right partners, having all the safety gear, you can reduce the chances of being caught or killed in an avalanche down to a really, really, really small number, but you can never make it zero.
I like that advice too, that you want a partner who will speak up and speak their mind to you. Mm-hmm. I think that's good advice for all of us as partners. Speak up when you see, you know, you and I are out skiing, and I can say, hey, Mark, this doesn't feel right. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And one thing I do that I think is a good practice, before I drop into any line, I talk to all the people I'm with, every person, and say, how do you feel about avalanches here? And just to break the ice, you know, like, are we making a good decision by choosing this slope to ski? So I think that's something we can drive home, is speak up if you have a problem. Nobody wants that partner that talk smack about you behind your back that afternoon with their other friends. Oh, I was out with John and he made bad decisions and I couldn't believe it. It's like, well, why didn't you just say something? Because you could have remedied the situation.
But it's really hard to do, to sometimes speak up. And so I think the onus is not just on us as a partner to speak up, but it's also a responsibility to listen. And I don't know if you've ever, you know, there are a lot of different personality types. One I often clue in on is they're the folks that are sometimes more outspoken, and that's great. I love that. People will say, Mark, that's a dumb idea. What are you doing? But have you ever noticed those other people in the group who are more observant and quiet?
Yes.
I've seen this in like in the search and rescue setting. They're just watching and listening. And think about the information they're gathering. They're not running their mouth. They're listening, observing. And you often have to ask them for their input, specifically call them out, not call them out, but walk over to them and quietly say, well, what do you think? And boy, they can have some really insightful comments sometimes, but you have to give them space to speak their mind. You have to maybe ask them to. And so I think it's not just the responsibility of folks to speak up, but it's the responsibility of us to to give them space to speak up or to ask them their thoughts. And those people can be really sharp and have good info for us.
That's really good insight. I think that, yeah, and that'd be a whole other podcast. But yeah, when you do see people, you see people on the Myers-Briggs, you know, personality scale, somebody who might be introverted and intuitive, that combination, I think, is the type of person that you're referring to. And that person is going to be somebody who's just literally taking in information, making profound calculations and coming out with strong outcomes. But because of their introversion, it might be harder to get that out of them. So I agree, you know, being a better listener, speaking up if you do see something wrong, but then also even asking, hey guys, how do we feel here? I think it's all fantastic advice. What is a typical work day in the backcountry like for you? And how do you create an avalanche forecast? And this is a 20 minute answer that maybe you can boil down to a couple minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, typical day in backcountry is just ripping awesome powder. Right?
Let's keep it simple.
We get out on a lot of horrible snow.
All right, I'm sure.
But we do find good powder occasionally. The typical day in the backcountry is often fairly targeted. Since we do have limited staff and limited time, we often have a question we're trying to answer. And we're going to places maybe where we haven't gotten a lot of observations, or maybe we're going to a place where we've gotten conflicting observations. And we're trying to usually answer a very specific question. And that drives where we go and what we do. And I find it really fun. It's really interesting. You're kind of like a detective. We've joked about it before. It's like a it's like an episode of CSI, except we call it Cold Smoke Investigations.
Sounds like a good job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it is really fun. You're out hunting for these clues, these answers from the snowpack. But getting back to part of your question about how we then make an avalanche forecast, the process I view is like imagine a giant funnel, and we're collecting all this information, all this data. And what we collect on a field day is just one drop that's going into that funnel. It might be a really key part of it. Ultimately, we're just trying to take a ton of info, grab it with this funnel, and then distill it down into a single thing that can sort of assimilate all this info into a danger rating and letting people know about the types of avalanches they're going to see, where they're going to happen, how big they're going to be. And probably another thing that I think of as sort of the secret sauce to all this is just now with smartphones, the text threads that we have internally, just the back and forth texting, the phone calls. There's a lot of informal stuff going on among our staff that really makes that happen. It's the discussions, or another member of my staff might say, Mark, hey, check out this one avalanche. And then that prompts me to go in and look at the photos of it. And then we'll get on the phone and talk about it and the significance of it. And so there are a lot of inputs to that funnel, but there's certain ones that really drive what we put into the avalanche forecast more than others. And we figure that out by just a lot of internal informal conversations, whether it's be text or phone or in person.
Great. And then all that is sort of distilled down to that quite simple discussion you guys put out each day with the avalanche danger rating. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about me, Mark. So you watched my little video of getting caught in an avalanche on Mount Superior on January 19th, 2019, I believe, and read my description of it. So could you just walk me through an analysis of that, you know, from your perspective, please?
Yeah, well, it's... I was trying to jog my memory because when you sent that to me, I realized I wrote the forecast that day.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's like, no.
it was a good forecast. It was right on.
I think the hardest thing for anyone to do, and myself included, it's one thing to talk about general conditions, and the forecast is for an entire mountain range. It's for a large area. It's not, can't be, and it's not for a slope by slope, very specific conditions. So the danger might be one thing overall for a broad area, but it could be quite a bit different on one slope versus another. And I think that's the hardest thing. And I don't know if you had skied a lot of other slopes or done a lot of other things that day. On every single slope you come to, make a new assessment. And it just in terms of danger rating, try and create your own danger rating and move that up or down depending on what you're seeing.
I think that might have been part of my flawed decision-making, as I had been skiing other slopes that day and we'd had great skiing. They weren't as consequential or as steep as this one. Mm-hmm. And then we rushed to get there and we were dropping in about 4 o'clock, you know, in that time of year in January was getting dark.
Oh, wow.
So I think it was, you know, this, just to give you more insight into my mindset.
What else had you seen that day?
I also should let you know, 2 days previously, I had skied that slope and I knew the exact avalanche danger there was. And that 2 days previously, I skied in an avalanche path. It's defeating to hike all the way up Mount Superior and ski bed surface down and like tumble the avalanche debris. So I thought, well, in a couple of days, that should be all cleared up. And I got up there. I knew the avalanche problem was kind of on those spines where those little wind pillows were. Uh-huh. And I stayed off of it at first. And then about 10 turns in, I got confident and thought, this is not going to slide. And I jumped onto that pillow and what did it do? It broke.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that's hard. That is really hard to do. You almost have to like make your decisions or have, make your plan before you get to the top. Because I'm like you, once I'm on top, it's like, there's only one way I'm going.
Like I'm going top to bottom. Here we go.
Yeah. 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 It is really, really hard to the, go back down the way you came up and not, and especially on a big mountain like Superior, you put a lot of effort into getting to the top. So you kind of have to make your decision before you get up there and then maybe you have other options. And it sounds like you kind of did. And I've been guilty of it too. Once you get going and the snow is good, you just kind of get into autopilot.
I still had the option to go ski the avalanche bed. I'd skied 2 days before. It was just, you know, 20, 30 feet over.
Yeah.
And I didn't because I thought, you know, oh, well, now we can do it. You know, I did that already and I paid my dues. Here I am. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the consequences of an avalanche can be drastically different between one place and another. And fortunately, that's one thing we get to choose. We can't really choose the snowpack, but we can choose where we ride. There was an interesting study done by Ian McCammon, and I don't remember if it was published or how rigorous it was, but he said that the question he was trying to answer for his students time and time again was, you know, we talk about this big consequential terrain, these big slopes and these big peaks, maybe slopes that could wash you off of a cliff or ones that end in terrain traps or can carry you through trees. And he was just curious, well, what about when there's none of that present? How often are avalanches hurting, injuring, or killing people due to trauma? And as I remember it, his conclusion through looking through a lot of accident data was, if there's none of that present, no trees, rocks, cliffs, terrain traps, typically the avalanche itself doesn't kill you. It's being buried. And so we can choose those slopes where we don't have those things present. And then it becomes a matter of, is the snow going to slide or not? If it does, we get buried or our partner's there to dig us out, but we can potentially survive that. So it's a whole nother level of risk when you throw in that terrain. Every avalanche is serious, but the terrain can magnify the consequences.
I think that's really a fantastic perspective. A quick takeaway there is, yes, if you can be out in the backcountry and choose a location that has no challenging things like trees, cliffs mm-hmm. to fall off, you know, in my case, mm-hmm. You know, high consequence terrain, you have a much better chance of being rescued by your partner. Continue. Thank you.
It's hard because something like Mount Superior, if people aren't familiar with it, it's really easy and quick to get to. And it's right there above when you're down at Alta, you're looking right at it. People ski it all the time. Imagine if Mount Superior were 20 miles deep in the Alaskan wilderness or something like that. I think we would be a little more scared of it. But
it's true.
I mean, it's like you can drive up there and you're there in 30 minutes. And, you know, a lot of people are pretty fit. They're on top in another 30 minutes. The margin for error when you're in that kind of terrain, and when I mean error, I mean the error in your estimation of the stability of the snow underneath you, your the margin of error in terms of like the line you decide to ride, are you 10 feet this way or that way of some spine? The margin for error gets really, really small on terrain like that. A number of years ago in Montana, I had written the forecast one morning and it was actually just solid low danger. And later that day, a young guy was skiing a couloir on a peak and triggered a very small pocket, kind of like you found, except because of the nature of the terrain, there was sort of a double fall line in the middle of the couloir. He got washed over a 200-foot cliff and died of trauma. And so I had been up at 4 that morning, reading the forecast. By about 4 that afternoon, I was in the helicopter landing, going to go pick up his body. His brother and his best friend had skied down to him, realized there was nothing they could do. They were, because of where they were, they actually had to leave him there and go get help. And then we were flying in the next, that afternoon to go get him. And I'll just never forget, it's just burned in my memory. I was standing there, that we had kind of gotten this guy packaged and ready to haul him out. And we called the helicopter to come back, and they had flown away to hook up the long line. And I just remember I was standing there in the snow with him, just me and this guy in the body bag. And I'm looking up at this couloir, and I remember thinking, that's exactly where I'd want to ski. And they had actually booted down the couloir a short distance to assess the snow and see if it was wind affected. For whatever reason, some winds had kind of blown down slope in the middle of that couloir and just made it a small little deposit of windblown snow that popped out when he hit it. But the problem was that terrain, because the way the fall line changed and caused him to get carried over those cliffs, there was just zero margin for error. And there are other couloirs, you've probably skied yourself, Miles, where it's just a perfect funnel of snow that goes down to a nice apron with a clean runout. And more I've lost my tolerance. I've done it, obviously. I know you've skied stuff like that. I've lost my tolerance for skiing or riding above, especially slopes that would wash me over a cliff band or something like that, because there's a lot I can't control, but what I can control is where I am and what the fall line looks like underneath me. And I'll never forget that, like looking up at that and just thinking, gosh, that could have been me. And maybe next time I should choose something where, when I have that razor thin margin of error, it's a numbers game and it's going to catch up with you eventually. So you got to stack the odds, stack the deck in your favor.
I think that's fantastic advice, and I can definitely relate to that. I've like you, have scared myself a bunch of times and been in situations where there wasn't any margin for error. Thank you for sharing that. How did that, you know, that really burned an image into my mind of you with the person who had passed away alone in that place, looking up. What was that like? Not just that day, but the process emotionally after that. What was that like for you?
It's nothing compared to what his brother and his friends and his family had to deal with.
Of course.
But all these accidents I've been to have just been burned into my memory. And I try to share these stories as much as I can. I wish everyone out there could be with me when I go to these accidents. It's learning that you can't, it's just priceless. You can't buy it. When I've walked in the steps, literally walked in someone's footsteps the moment before they got caught in an avalanche and died, feeling the wind on my face, seeing the slope in front of me. It's almost hard to really quantify how all that adds up, but as a human, as an emotional creature, it really sticks with you. And I carry that with me, all those events, wherever I go. And I hope it'll keep me alive. I want to be able to share this stuff. And I think we try to as much as we can when we have our accidents. We try and get some footage, and for the, you know, in the name of the person that sometimes was involved in the accident, share all that with the public so that they can at least sort of maybe feel like they were there and identify with it and carry home some of the same lessons that we do.
Well, thanks again for sharing that. And I will keep that with me as well. So that's what's so valuable about sharing these very powerful situations, scenarios, and accidents. That it's hard to share, but when you do, you know, I think me and I hope our listeners can keep that with us as well as we move forward into the mountains.
You know, the one thing though, like thinking about Mount Superior though, it's easy to sit here and say, oh, you know, choose a different slope. And it's like you see 100 people ski it.
That,
like, well,
I mean,
come on. I want my turn.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I want my turn. You know, I guess the hardest thing and probably one of the biggest lessons someone told me a long time ago was to let go that we're going to be able to, whether it's Mount Superior or whatever, let go of the fact that we're going to be able to do that anytime we want. And it doesn't matter what other people do. They said, you know, if you end up skiing or climbing or riding your chosen line half the time, that's pretty darn good. And sort of reframing things a little bit. And, you know, Mount Superior is a good example. People ride it all the time. But for me personally, it's a beautiful ski descent, but I'm in it for the long haul. I want to be skiing it when I'm 70 years old. So if I have to walk away from it one day and just wait all season long to cherry pick that one day when things are right for me, that's what I'm going to do so that I can do it next year and the year after that and the year after that and the year after that. I guess it just takes practice walking away from things or not even going up there. Because yeah, like I said, once you get up there, you're going to ski it. You might not, but that is really hard. So just not putting yourself in that position and accepting that you might not get to do it whenever you want is the main thing. That's the skill that takes practice.
I'm going to repeat your friend's fantastic advice. If you ski your chosen line half the time, that's pretty good. All right, Mark, we're going to jump into some rapid fire avalanche questions. So I'm going to ask kind of quick, concise questions. And if you can give quick, concise answers, that'll be great. And we'll rip through a bunch of these.
All right, bring it.
All right. It's almost like a game show. All right. So here's a great one we hear a lot. Can loud noises trigger avalanches?
Nope, not at all.
How fast do avalanches travel?
In seconds, they can be going 60 miles an hour. And pretty quickly after that, they can be going 100. Speaking of Mount Superior, there was someone last season who got caught in an avalanche. They were tracking themselves on Strava, and they were clocked going 77 miles an hour.
His human body going 70 miles an hour.
Yes. And he was not skiing. He was tumbling.
Whoa. What kind of weather causes avalanches?
Any weather that puts a rapid change onto the snowpack. Tons of snow, rain, huge change in temperature, big jump in wind. In simple terms, anytime we get rapid change.
What percentage of avalanche accidents are caused by avalanches triggered by the victim or someone in the victim's party?
9 out of 10. So 90% of the time, we're triggering those avalanches.
What percentage of avalanche victims die from being hurt in the slide?
So you have everyone that dies, about 25% are killed by trauma. That's the bad news. The good news, though, is that 3 out of 4 survive, and if we're prepared, we can rescue them.
At what forecasting hazard level do most avalanche deaths occur?
It's generally in the considerable, even to the moderate range, but that's also a function of a lot of times the avalanche danger is at those levels for big parts of the year. But it's also because the signs of danger are a little less obvious.
How do people get caught in avalanches?
Depends on the type of avalanche, but when it's a dry slab avalanches, you are right in the middle of it and it breaks all the way around you and there's no room to escape.
How do people die when buried in an avalanche?
Well, if the trauma doesn't kill them, then you basically run out of air.
How do you define avalanche terrain?
In simple terms, it's any slope steeper than 30 degrees, but it's also flat terrain underneath those steeper slopes. So that's where the avalanche will run down and deposit all the snow.
What should you do if you get caught in an avalanche?
The question should be, what should you do to be prepared? And once you're caught, you are not in control. So you hope everything's been lined up with your partners that they're ready to respond and save your butt.
How long can you survive buried in an avalanche?
How long can you hold your breath, Miles?
Not very long, like a minute. Not even a minute.
Yeah, so there you go. But no, it's at about 15 minutes, the number of people that survive drops off, just bottoms out. So you got less than that, probably even less than that. I wouldn't want to be stuck in the snow more than just a few minutes.
Are men or women more prone to triggering and getting caught in avalanches?
Well, as a guy, I'm pretty dumb. So I'm probably more likely to get caught and hurt in an avalanche.
Are big groups or small groups better in avalanche terrain?
It's a catch-22. With a big group, you have more resources. But anyone who's traveled with a big group knows it can also get more complicated. with the decision making and all the group dynamics that can occur with larger groups.
What can we do this preseason to brush up on our avalanche skills?
Do whatever you can. The cool thing this year is that there is a ton of stuff being put out virtually and online. So there are a ton of great resources. Tune in, do something, read something, watch something, anything you can do to learn more about avalanches.
Last season, Little Cottonwood Canyon in Utah experienced a 3-foot storm in early February that caused 48 avalanches in 72 hours. 21 of those avalanches hit the road. People were not allowed to leave their homes or hotels, what they call Inner Lodge in Utah, or enter nor leave the canyon for 54 hours. The roads were closed, everything. So just real quick, what caused this? How common is this kind of event? And what was it like as a forecaster?
A really simple rule of thumb that we should all remember is more snow equals more avalanches. And I'm not sure the snow totals, if it might have been more than 3 feet. What I do remember is that it was almost 7 inches of water.
Whoa.
So when you take all that snow that fell and if you melted it down, it'd be 7 inches of water. When you think that here in Salt Lake, we might have gotten an inch of rain all summer long, that's an amazing amount of precipitation. So tons of snow, real simple formula, means avalanches. How common is this? I think one cool thing about the Cottonwood Canyons is that the way the storms line up and the way things get funneled up there, they can see snowfall rates and storms that you typically don't see in sort of the inner mountain ranges. These are storms that are more common on the coastal ranges where you get these storms that come off the Pacific and just slam into the mountains. Well, for a lot of reasons, this happens in the Wasatch Range. So it can be fairly common.
And what was it like as a forecaster? Was it easy because it was just no go, stay home?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what type of forecaster you are. It's on our end, it's pretty easy. We sit back in the office and when you get those snowfall rates and those snowfall totals, things are dangerous. You're going to see avalanches. The harder thing to know sometimes is not how the avalanche danger is rising, but at what rate, how quickly or how slowly does it then subside? And that's a much harder question to answer. When is that avalanche danger dropping? If you're an avalanche forecaster working for UDOT up in Little Cottonwood Canyon, it's a totally different scenario. They are running around. They have got their hands full. And I feel lucky I just get to hang out down in the office and watch it all unfold and then hear their stories. A good example is I remember that during that storm, I was talking to one of them at 4 a.m. and he was down kind of near Snowbird. And the reason he had time to talk on the phone is because an avalanche had crashed down onto the road in front of him. An avalanche had crashed down onto the road behind him.
Whoa.
We were just sitting there in the middle waiting to be dug out. So we had time.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So that's the main thing, I think, when we're all down in line at the bottom of the canyon, getting frustrated that we can't get up there. It's not because they're not busy. They are working their tails off trying to make sure it's safe. Because once they open that road, it has to be there's going to be a line of traffic up there. And that's pretty scary to think of families with small kids sitting there underneath those big avalanche paths. So they've got a heavy burden and a high workload when these things happen.
Wow. Well, hats off to the UDOT avalanche forecasters and all the UDOT people that keep those roads open for us. They are amazing human beings.
Yeah. And the scariest too, they're a big part of that. Those ski patrol workers work hand in hand.
Absolutely. Hats off to them as well. Well, Mark, that's all I've got for you. Do you have anything else you'd like to add or drive home to our audience right now?
UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
Absolutely. And yeah.
For anything in Utah, and then avalanche.org for the country, avalanche.ca. Check that forecast before you head out.
And then if people want to donate to the Utah Avalanche Center, they go to that website as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely. Or submit observations and avalanche accidents.
Yeah, absolutely. Please reach out to us, submit an ob, or if there's any reason someone's hesitant, they can certainly send us an email, give us a call. There are a lot of ways to reach us, and we'll take any type of information that we can get.
And we will have all that information at the end of this podcast, as well as in the description of this podcast. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mark. This was damn fun. Have a great rest of your day, and I very do much want to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Miles. I appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Please visit the Utah Avalanche Center's website at utahavalanchecenter.org. On their website, you can find their daily avalanche forecast, and you can also submit observations and avalanche accidents. You can also find the Utah Avalanche Center on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you so much for listening to the Snow Brains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snow Brains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snow Brains. This episode of the Snow Brains podcast was brought to you by Alta Ski Area. The editing of this episode was done by Robert Wilkinson. The music was created by Chad Crouch. I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark. Thank you for listening.